I'm terribly sorry to keep you waiting. It's very irresponsible. But the taxi driver, I don't know, there's some kind of collision in front of us, you know, all that sort of good stuff. But the cyclist made it, you'll be pleased to know. Sarah, there you are. Plug this in carefully at some stage. Good. Well, what did I write in the blurb? Lightning fast startup, isn't that right? Good, just checking. You never know. Read the telephone directory to you while this starts up. What am I supposed to talk about? Yes, well, we're improving the startup time, you'll be pleased to know. Which is great. And it's getting there. Hopefully you'll see the cold start. You experience that in a minute. And when this arrives. And then we can look at the warm start and so on. But I'd recommend to you, Mike Leibowitz's talk. Is that next? Yeah. Excellent. Performance improvements as well. So, there you are. I also have to point out that Jan Holosowski unfortunately can't be with us because he's had a baby. Actually, his wife had a baby. But that's very exciting, so.
Do you think you could turn me?
Oh, Peter, you can help me. There's some alarm thing on there. If you could turn the whole thing off, that would be wonderful. Did we get anything?
Oh.
Oh, you have to turn the projector on.
Yeah, I think so.
I knew there was a fatal flaw somewhere in this scene. Doesn't look on.
Doesn't seem to.
Control, my controllers. There, any sign of life? Could be the laptop, of course. You never know. Yeah? No?
I don't know.
Yes? There's no power to the projector. Normally would say no signal.
I don't know.
It's warming up.
It's warming up. Okay, I'm too big. Let's try again. Uh-huh. Okay. Ah, good. We can see something. That's excellent.
Why are we doing this on purpose so that you can later show us how really fast it is?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. Yep, no, you're right. I would point out that the login time here is not stellar. But I've done some work to fix that, please tell me. So it should be at least twice as fast and probably better at some stage. Particularly here, Nautilus is not loading in the background. Something else is blocking it due to re-enter and activation stuff. Anyway, good. So here we are. This is the desktop. Let me find my my slides, which I think are somewhere here. So I found this image, which I think is So we need to examine the cold start time here. It's not looking good, right? But the splash was quick. Did you notice the splash? That was quick.
Yep.
Good. Excellent. Let me see. I like Gen 2 as much as anyone else, but there you are. I found that on the web somewhere. I can get kicked out afterwards. So let me see if the presentation is here somewhere. Okay. So this is what I'm going to talk about. Right. So there are basically several problems of performance and several sort of archetypes of the problem. The course brief. The first and, I guess, biggest problem that I don't address at all is scraping the stuff off the oxide. This takes forever. You have to spin the little wheel around and find where all the data is, and inevitably the data is being carefully arranged, in a way scattered across the disk, such that it takes almost forever to load. You don't want me to walk in front of it? Okay, fine. I'll stand in this corner.
No.
Or up here. Oh, you want to see me? No, you don't want to see me. Okay. So so this takes ages and ages, and so Intel are doing some great work here to help reorder the data blocks. In some sense, I guess, to fragment files instead of kind of defragmenting them, such that you read them in the order you want them. But that's one big cause of performance pain. The other things are algorithmic stupidities. Linking is a prime example of this, as we've seen before, last year, I guess. Poor I/O management. There's a lot of the Linux kernel I/O stuff, in my view, could just be a lot better if they managed I/O more cleverly. And then I guess bad code is a big area of problems. And often the code is not really bad, it's just optimized for a previous era, let's say. You know? So there are some things in Configuration Manager, for example, I'll show you later, that are great if you want the design requirements that were current at the time, and we don't now. and I guess memory burn. So memory burn really ties into all of these other things. The more memory you allocate, the more you have to push off the disk on a small memory machine, and so the more I/O you do, which really kills you. Of course, memory is free if you have free memory, right? But once you don't, it gets expensive. So yeah, I guess the other thing is that before you try optimizing anything, it's necessary to profile it, right? Totally pointless optimizing without profiling, because you inevitably choose the wrong thing to fix. So let's choose the right thing to fix. So this is a nice picture of K cache grind. This runs a simulated CPU, and it has various weights for various cache lines, and so you can do a whole load of things. It also has a joke cycle estimation, guesstimation feature built in, but since the numbers look kind of reasonable, I've put them here. Unfortunately, it emits some of the larger performance hits, like atomic reference counting, that just don't show up here at all, are actually quite expensive. But it at least gives you a rough idea of what's slow. So what is slow? Yeah? Well, I'd like to argue that this bit here is the slow bit. Do you think that's fair? It also appears here, and here, and here, and here, and here. So the aggregate area in this histogram seems pretty convincing that linking is rather an issue. And this DLOOKUP axis, you notice here, I'll walk in front and point, is all in ld.so. This is the glibc Linux linker. So this is really a Linux-focused performance talk, though some of it's more widely useful, I suppose. And yeah, just millions and millions of cycles doing nothing. It's 736 simulated million cycles linking. After some of our optimizations, we get this down to 191. And so this is good, right? There are several hacks that we pulled, and I can tell you about some of them later. Some of them are in contemporary Linux systems and going into the next generation quickly. And the thing, from my perspective, is that this bit that I've been responsible for is now smaller than Configuration Manager, which is all of this purple stuff here scattered all over the place, right? So we've moved the problem somewhere else, which is great. But hopefully we've also drastically accelerated startup time. So that's all the profiling tells you. I'll tell you a bit about the linking stuff. So I did some research to come up with some fixes for the linking thing. One was basically just to do link hashing a lot more intelligently, drastically reduce the working set. And that gives about a 50% win on the linking, which as you saw was quite a chunk of OpenOffice startup by itself. Relatively non-controversial, although seemingly Red Hat, talking to Quayle the other day, wherever he is, said that they've chosen to use the really controversial parts of my patch, such that nothing you build on a new Fedora will run on an old one, which is a kind of interesting choice. They're also not taking my vdirect work, which I think takes, so it takes a factor of 150 out of OpenOffice startup linking time in 3/4 of the symbols. So unfortunately, you just get left with a quarter of them, so it's really a factor of 4. But we just can't do much better on those quarter. Refused to be even reviewed by the maintainer. Not read correctly, no responses, very unfortunate. But that gives a very nice speed up. And then we have a hack which is deployed, I suppose, in all the Novell builds, which does a similar thing in terms of reducing linking scope. I have a picture to explain how that works, just quickly. And I won't bore you endlessly with linking, quickly. Yeah. So one of the nice punchlines that Kai will perhaps appreciate at the back is this is good for UNO components, you know, they become very cheap. So we can componentize the thing a whole lot more. But one of the reasons why we search all of these 150 libraries as we link is to find what's called vague linkage symbols. Now, if you can imagine, I had some chalk. Aha, excellent. So in C++, there's this nice feature. I'm just going to show you what a vague linkage symbol is, because most people don't get it. You ought to. So if you have a class foo, you're recording all of this, that's important. And you have an inline function. Inline functions are great, right? Because they're really, efficient, inline, all that sort of thing. Must be good, right? And the function is called var, and it's Java name, of course. And so inside this you have a static variable, like static. What's after foo and var? Baz? Int. Baz is 3. And then, hey, you do something with baz and so on. The problem with this guy is, of course, that every time you get class foo and you call this var function, this is inlined, right? And as all of us programmers know, incidentally, how many people are programmers? I see a few. Come on, Ike, you've got to be responsive here. You know, I'm getting a. Ah, he's a programmer. He's not listening. Poke him, dude. Poke him. This is in line everywhere, but somehow this bass has to be the same in all instances, right? Otherwise the whole static keyword loses any meaning. This is bad. So what you have to do is you have to look all the way down all of these loads to see if there are any other people that have inlined this and it has the same value, so that it all resolves to one actual integer, or bass, which is as you'd expect. Now the problem is that this is quite easy to understand, but there are a whole load of type information things and, well, basically loads of other stuff too that isn't really vague linkage, but is sort of tagged as such, that they go searching through all of these libraries to find. And that's really silly. And there's various ways to fix this, and there's some compiler hacks that we'll be coming up with to improve that. But it's called the one definition rule, ODR. There has to be just one definition of these things. So what the hack does is it recognizes that the only really important case in OpenOffice, and we cross our fingers and hope that this is true, is exceptions. And the only things that are thrown between libraries like SVX and something else is going to be an UNO exception. And so since we know all of the UNO exceptions ahead of time, what we can do is we can compile all of these and all of their type information into a nice library which we call libexcept or some other random name. And this lives early in the search path. Is that mine?
No, you're off.
No, I'm off. That's good. Someone else.
You sure?
We're not going to explode. Good. Okay, so when you've got that type information there, you can be sure that it's there. You only have to search up to here, and you know it's there, and it's in the global scope. So what that means is that all of these libraries, instead of having this 150-long scope, they can just branch off here and search this and all the children of it, which is much faster. Yeah. So we move 150 down to some small, much smaller number. And the better thing is that all of these guys are then hidden away. Their dependents just don't appear in the whole linking scope of these other things. So this saves, again, a huge chunk of time. And the really beautiful thing about this is it's totally under our control. We don't have to talk to maintainers of glibc or anything. We just write, I think, patches, 50, 60 lines of code, and a list of libraries which are kosher to do this with. So that's pretty cool. And we should get that in. Stefan Bergman had some comments. And it's going upstream for 1-1. And it gives you a nice win. Of course, it assumes that all these, all the cross-library vague symbols are just exceptions, and they're only UNO exceptions. And that seems to work. It seems to be a fair assumption. And it gives a substantial win. I forget the exact numbers, but it's something like 400 milliseconds out of 2 seconds or something like that. So it's quite a nice big chunk of my machine. So then there's a whole load of cheating closer. Doko. Where is it integrated? It's in OO build, and since you're using it, you're getting it. Okay. I think. If you have it turned on, maybe Debian turn it off. Who knows? It's also got a Linux dependency in it. It uses li suffixes to detect internal libraries. So if your library is vcl680li.so, then it assumes the 680li implies it's an internal library, and hence this rule applies. If it's not, then it doesn't do it inside the shared library loader. It's a hack, right? It just happens to be a good hack. That works well. So, sleight of hand speed ups. So there are a whole load of ways you can apparently improve performance without actually improving it, and make people happy, which is good. And there are a whole load of other cheating evilnesses that that people get up to. So Firefox, and I'm always being told to do a Firefox. How do you do a Firefox? Anyway, Firefox, which is wonderful and notable for its almost total lack of UI, and hence ability to rewrite the UI very easily, statically links virtually everything, since it does just one thing. And so it's really, they don't have a lot of these linking problems. Still fairly slow to read up. And of course they have this factory process design as well, so there's only actually one guy sitting there chewing your RAM, or your X server resources, or whatever. KDE also have a cheat, of course. They have lots of processes, and so they have a thing called KDE init that is forked, and that then forks and dlopens executables and runs them. So when you look at a KDE system that's running, when you do a PS tree, you notice that though you seem to be running lots of processes, they're all called KDE init something, right? And basically, this is just a reflection of the one process that's forked into lots of others, DL opens the small bit of application, hopefully, having relocated all the other libraries, and then runs that. Which is nice work if you can get it, but the problem is it doesn't help us at all, because we don't share our infrastructure with anyone else, which is a problem too, but we'll fix that slightly. Microsoft Office, of course, it is said, fragments into all these tiny pieces and then loads them much more efficiently. They don't have the linking problems. But our problem is that we can't, or we couldn't previously, fragment OpenOffice into too many libraries without losing again on the linking time. So, you know, you gain by loading less, but you lose by having to link it more slowly. And Office, of course, does a whole load of pretty clever I/O reordering and so on and so on. I'm sure I'll be talking about that. So how do we cheat already? Well, so OpenOffice can sit in the background, and when you start a second OpenOffice, you don't run all of OpenOffice, you just start a little piece. Hopefully that means you start quicker and you don't duplicate resources, and it also helps you manage locking on your configuration storage and so on. And we also cache stuff in your home directory, so I forget how big the configuration manager cache is. Must be someone here. Malta? Kai? Configuration manager cache? Megabytes, anyway. 2 megabytes, I'll say. This one here is about 2.4 megabytes when you've opened every component. So, at some possibly substantial expense, you can store a whole load of stuff in your home directory. That may speed up startup time when you start again, although it may be on an NFS server that's not particularly responding fast, it may actually slow down startup, but at least you tried, right? Good. So making our startup apparently faster is quite easy, actually. And I had a great idea from Hans Rowling when I spoke to him. Clever chap, right? And he had this idea for a second starter that's just a very small application, right? So you have this huge OpenOffice beast over here. And in your OpenOffice on your machine, unless you use OOBuild derivative, basically, if you want to run another OpenOffice, you know it's going to use a factory mode and reuse this guy. But first you load and you relocate absolutely tons of this code before realizing, oh, wait a minute, there's already one there. Let's you know, shut down with a whole load more resources and time and just pass the arguments across. Now, this doesn't seem a very wonderful use of resources. So instead, we have a very small, quick, simple piece of there's a pipe there, pushes the arguments down it, and it's very fast. People used to encourage me. They'd come to me and encourage me at conferences. You know, you have to speak to people, and they say, OpenOffice startup, why is it so slow? Well, they don't do it in a very gentle way, though. They say things like, how is it numeric can start completely before this can render it splash? And you're like, that is a good question. Why is it? Why is it? So what we did was we created a splash application as well. So this little pipe process renders a splash. It requires only X and glib, but it's a tiny bit. And it starts almost instantly. And I'll show you some numbers before. So our splash screen is someone else's, right? No, it doesn't get splashier than that. And the nice thing about that is, of course, that we can then get rid of startup notification almost completely. You know, the little cursor that sits there going, I'm busy, something might happen, oh, and here it is, you know? So that would be rather good. So we'll see that. But again, it's a perception rather than reality. The fact that when you clicked and asked it to do something, something happened quickly, at least initially, makes people think OpenOffice starting faster, even though it's clearly not. So there you are. Here's a graph of some of the times. As you remember, I was talking about cold start performance and the problem of opening and touching lots of files. And of course, if you haven't run OpenOffice before, you don't want to go touching a whole lot of files, you know, because they're probably not in cache, you have to go and seek on the disk. But I think 270 files is what OpenOffice touches currently, just to the point where it realizes there's a pipe and exits, right? So it's not actually ever going to do anything, and it touches all these files that may not be there. And we touch, you know, like way fewer. This, of course, includes shared libraries and all sorts of stuff. Similarly, the time it takes to actually get to the point where you can write the arguments down the pipe, which is all you're supposed to be doing in this mode, is drastically reduced. And, you know, the time to the splash screen, again, not having all these dependencies pieces, again, it's of the order of tens of milliseconds instead of, several hundred. So that's a good thing, I hope, right?
Excellent. I apologize.
You won't interrupt.
Our viewers around, because it's being streamed directly live, are sending messages and they cannot see the slides. So if you could explain the slides from this side with your hands so they can see.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Well, yeah, did they see the chart?
Yeah. I think we did.
That's good. Okay. That's good. Okay, right. Fine.
Thank you.
Oh, this is the bit that I was supposed to fill in about the problems of getting this, you know, minor optimization and win upstream. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough time. However, there you are. The patch has been around for ages now, and we've done a whole load of work fixing it and addressing every possible objection, and the current objection is there's no solution for Windows. So that's a good reason to block a Unix feature. Anyway, let's ignore that and not get too bitter and twisted all in front of people. So another thing we did was making it usable, the sys tray. So as you see, the second time you start OpenOffice, it's very much quicker, right? Which is good. But the problem is you really want OpenOffice to linger around in the background like a bad smell, chewing your resources, so that the second time you start, every time you open a document, it is the second time, you know, right? There's always something there. And the way to do that on Windows is with a sys tray, little icon down here, that is the quick starter. And so, this basically does almost nothing, and probably few people use it, but it allows you to control the life cycle. Really, the only really important people here is probably this button and this button. And this checkbox says, don't do this next time, I don't want all my resources chewed. And this guy says, just So that's kind of useful, but it makes the second starter much more valuable because people don't really know this is happening in the background, and you can fob them off with this stuff. It's great. So cheesy buttons. Oh yeah, and you can also create these things easily. It's probably ergonomic if you want to go to this tiny button at the bottom and click on it. You can create stuff. It complies with the free desktop specification for quick starting. Yes. Oh, and it's almost instant apply. Yeah, the first cut is in 2.1, but since we haven't got that upstream yet, I don't know whether the other features will work. So you see can you see at the bottom here where all my little icons are? If you stand on your neighbor's shoulders, you might be able to. Anyway, let me see. So in Tools Options here, we have a nice button we can click somewhere. Tools Options Memory. Yeah, the Eat My Memory button is here. And as you go OK, you notice that I'm not running the hacked version with the improvement in it. But either way, as you go OK, and in this version you restart, it will then pop up the little quick starter at the bottom, and you'll be able to just use it immediately, which is nice. And I think we really do need to be moving to more instant apply stuff. I'm actually frustrated enough to... No, maybe I'll demo it at the end. Because a lot of the options there are just... a lot of these options don't apply really very instantly, and the life cycle of them is not that clear. OK, good. Let me get on. Memory issues. So what I've been looking at most recently is memory chew. And there are a number of areas where there's quite a lot of memory use where we shouldn't be using it. Of course, is that my phone again?
Yeah.
Better just throw it out the window. I don't know, you have to unlock it, Noel, before you can turn it off. I think that's probably the thing. Which is the middle tip and then the start. So it turns out that there's quite a lot of heap wastage that we do. We go allocating all sorts of duplicate stuff on the heap, which is good. But by far the largest use of memory is other things that we go memory mapping, and particularly shared libraries. There's just such a huge amount of code being loaded, and of course then accessed in a very random pattern, which is bad for the working set. So really we need to shrink the amount of code we're loading, and well, I've got some ideas about how to do that, but it's not my focus at the moment. So the first thing I discovered, having started to address some of these memory problems in earnest, is this great tool. I showed you Valgrind some pretty pictures earlier from Kcache Grind. And there's this cool tool called Valgrind that generates all of this, and it has a great framework for it, and it rocks. And there's a space profiler in there, which is wonderful, right? Because it just works and you don't instrument anything. The problem is, it produces a number that's profoundly misleading, like really useless. I spent ages, I am bitter and twisted on this, I spent ages optimizing something that wasn't the problem. But basically it measures space-time, so your application starts and it does something like this, and then there's a long plateau. And then it quits again. And space-time, I guess, is the product of, this by this. Sort of integrated over all time and then, tried to be broken down again to the various things. But the problem is, this guy appears to have been around for a long time. And incidentally, this bit is ignored, I think, this long quiescent period. Because they're all the same, right? So basically, you look at this piece, and this huge allocation here is only as much as this allocation here. But clearly, this is where the memory is being wasted, right? Not here. Just because this was around for a longer time, it's really not actually that relevant, because this is always going to be around for the whole lifetime of the application, as is this. I guess it probably is a useful thing when you have a very peaky allocation process and you can't see what's going on. But that's certainly not OpenOffice. And it's really blighted by the fact that you can't say, tell me what's happening here, what's the breakdown at this point. Sorry, in case this was not clear, this is space versus time. So instead, I'd recommend you use SpeedProf or MemProf. which is I'd say ideal. I have a slightly vested interest here. It's quite a nice tool. A friend of mine wrote it, and I kind of get to maintain it when it breaks. So it gives you accurate full stack information, and no recompiles necessary. The wiki page is there, and here's a picture. Maybe if I have time and I finish horribly early, I'll show it to you. Actually running on my presenting version. So I don't know. What do we see here? We see that there's been this much memory allocated, 94.17.103, lovely. And it, basically, it's tracking all the threads, hooking their allocators, and piping the information down a pipe, including full stack frames. It's amazing how fast that actually is. I mean, the performance impact may be a factor of 4 to 8. You need good symbols to see really what's going on, but you know, the punchline is here. We allocate 8 meg of, in this binary, strangely, and a chunk of it in font config and so on and so on. I guess this is because there's a custom allocator in there, maybe, I don't know. And then you have full stack information, so you can see what was called, how much, the self, the aggregate total, and so on, and mine it, and discover that it's configuration manager chewing all the memory in some strange data structure. So, having analyzed this, you start to see some patterns, and some of the first ones I looked at was the image strip stuff. So, OpenOffice previously was storing images in strips, which helps if you're pushing them to the X server, pardon me, disappear behind the screen here. Yes, it's all the same price. Anyway, I got this in the end. And the problem with the image strips is that they're really bad for your working set, right? But you can push them into the X server, so it's a very fast resource in terms of rendering. But basically, so what they have is a picture like this. Well, I won't destroy this board, but let's just make it up here, I guess. It's massive. It's sort of 10,000 pixels wide, right? And 32 high. So this is a really weird thing. Apparently there have been all sorts of problems with X servers. And this is kind of a non-typical use case. And it's just split up into little bits with a smiley face here and a file thing here or whatever. And so on, just icon after icon after icon after icon. And that's fine. And it's arranged in memory, but the problem is it's arranged in rows, right? So when you turn this into a linear thing, first you have this top row, which goes along here, folder, smiley, whatever, hundreds of others, thousands of others, and then you have folder, smiley, the other, here, again, the second row down, folder, smiley, the other, the third row down, and so on. And the problem is that maybe only the smiley is displayed in your application in this group of however many thousand, but when you start looking at a 4K page here, which is the granularity used for the memory manager, you have all of these other icons in it, right? So the 4K page is, it's maybe something like this. But it includes absolutely tons of these other icons, all of their first row, right? So if you consider 4K of this, maybe we can get 4K divided by 32 divided by 4. It's 1K divided by 32. Anyway, it's quite a lot, right? Quite a lot of icons get shoved in a page. And of course, quite a number of these are used, and they're all scattered around the place. So the net effect is that you have to keep this huge image constantly mapped into memory. And when you need some memory, and there is none, you can't page it out because some clown is chopping 32 bytes out of the middle of it, or 64 or whatever, and not using any of the rest of it at all. So it's very irresponsible. And it worked really well on 8-bit computers or old hardware. This is a really good design choice in the past. It's just no longer a good design choice. So instead what you want is you want the image to be vertical instead, and 10K. Things long and 32 wide. So I started to look into this, and we read all our images from the zip file anyway. So we have this nice big package here with all of our, all of our images shoved in it in some compressed form and whatever. And this is just one file. It's quite a big file, 5 meg, something like that. But it's fairly easy to get to. And what we were doing previously was turning this zip data, unzipping it, and turning it into this huge strip, and then writing that back to your home directory. And creating a 2.4 meg cache somewhere. And then reloading that at each time. It just seemed to me a rather strange way to use memory and do this. So I just rewrote the image list piece to just store the images that we want. There is no cache anymore in this at all. There's just these images coming out of the zip file. And in order to make this fast, because clearly we don't want to seek at all, we have a little tool that knows what is in the UI and what order it's in. So what order are we going to ask for it in? So you have an XML description of your UI, which is a really nice part of the new framework stuff. and you can crunch that and determine what a good order is, such that all of these icons that we want in the stock OpenOffice are all on this first page here. You can read them linearly, effectively uncompress them, whack them in memory, and have a single image, singleton. You know, there's only one smiley in the whole process to render the smiley in your toolbar. There was also a horrific bug discovered during this process, such that these images, I believe, are loaded again and again for each time you have a new image list. So when you open a new window, it would load this cached thing again and again and again. And these are, as I say, big. So this saves really quite a lot of memory, as it turns out, having just one image instead of lots of them, and you know, potentially a far smaller set of images, and again, drastically improves the working set. So you know, even if you have all your images loaded, you know, you'll still have a much better swap performance. So that's good. Saves a load of memory in your home directory, improves the working set, simplifies the code. Yeah, so save about 3 meg, I think, overall, and some, I forget, 1 megabyte maybe a window. And that's good. Yeah. Yeah, so and there's some complicated Perl script that reads all the XML files and sorts and stuff and so on and so on. Questions, anyone? I see Tor questioning me here. Go for it.
Why do we have the zip file at all? Why not just give the image as such?
So the zip file is really nice because it aggregates loads of tiny images into a single place on the disk.
Why not just store that big thing?
Why not store the big thing here like this? Yeah, we used to do that. And it was stuck in a resource file. The problem is with these strips as well, icons are in fact duplicated across them. So you can have the open icon in several of these places. And you know, one application needs it and another one doesn't. So to some degree it saves to have them fragmented up like this. And I mean, it's nice to have them in a single file. If they were scattered across the file system, it would be much harder to read them quickly because you want to use more seeks and you waste lacks for file space. Yeah, so no real performance impact on startup. There's some latency though. So if you go file, okay, that wasn't slow. Anyway, so there is some latency with loading menus with this patch, you know, because there's a whole load of icons that may not be so contiguous as the ones that you load on startup. But I think we can probably defeat that by having some idle handler that just, you know, loads the few icons that are going to be in the menus anyway. So, cool. Strings. Yes, lots of strings are allocated again and again. So when you're creating all of your UNO strings or any RTL string at all that's used programmatically, like a name of something or a configuration path or whatever, you tend to use something like create from ASCII or some moral equivalent. There's this lovely macro that's about this long in programming terms, RTL, ustring, const from ASCII here. And you know, it puts the string length in as well or something, you know, for some marginal performance win. It would be nice to have truly constant strings so we could share across processes. But anyway, lots of people do this, and each time you do this, of course, it creates a new string. But this string here is reference counted to avoid duplication, you know, so that you can share the same string and it's immutable and it has these number of nice properties. But every time you do this, you create another one. So I thought, well, it's interesting. We're allocating, you know, I don't know, 2 megabytes of string overall. So what you know, how does it break down? I say 2 megabytes. The numbers vary that I say wildly, depending on who you ask, because there's really two numbers. There's one that malloc returns. There's one that you get by adding up the lengths of all the strings as they're actually recorded. And there's one that pmap returns. And they just reflect different things. Of course, the system allocator has some performance, space overhead. And of course, strings may claim to be smaller than they actually are. You can allocate a string buffer and then, you know, maybe not reallocate it to the right length, I think. I think I'm seeing some of that stuff. Anyway, so the question is, how many strings are duplicates of each other, right? Well, it turns out about 90% of strings are identical by size, identical to other strings that we already have. And the only 10% of strings by size, and so total bytes, are actually unique. So there's obviously some fruit for easy fixing here. Unfortunately, the way you detect this, or the way I detect it, was to create a hash that just tracks every single string as it gets created and destroyed, and prints out on the console, now I have 100 strings, now I have 200 strings, and so on. And you bite this to tail, run OpenOffice, and think, now we have 32,000 strings, set a magic variable and just dump the hash when you get to 32,000. So, you know, you catch this peak of string allocation. You know, it goes up like this and plateaus, and you try and catch it here by knowing what that number is, and so just dump all strings at this point. So, you know, you miss maybe 2% because it's not, you know, incredibly accurate, but that's pretty good. And so then you look at the strings and try and find out who's allocating them or where. And, you know, also LXR helps with that, of course, but I tend to put breakpoints in on various things and hacky bits of code to find where the strings are. And there's a number of scattered patches that I think start drastically reducing the pipeline and some new numbers, but yeah, there's a lot more to go in Configuration Manager. On the plane, I managed to save nearly a megabyte from Configuration Manager by using reference counted strings instead of the rather strange duplicated internal state of a small cache. That's just names of keys. Again and again and again, the same keys. You know, you're part of the schema, it's got this field, this field, this field, this field, and then, you know, thousands of them. And yeah, just saving those few strings. Again, in VCL, there's a huge font mapping file to map, you know, Times New Roman to, and then a huge list of fonts that we fall back through. Turns out this was chewing a huge amount of memory as well. Well, let me show you I'll see if I can find the spreadsheet. I think I've got it here, 10 new strings. And you can have a look for yourself, see what you think it is. It's not a small spreadsheet, and the load time is not altogether wonderful either. But there's where the part chain comes from. Actually, I was unfair about Configuration Manager. Most of the ones that I saw and blamed on Configuration Manager weren't. They just looked like they were kind of configuration keys. Turns out Configuration Manager has its own string class that I wasn't looking at all. So I didn't capture any of that. But we've looked at that now. So here's the number of strings. So I don't know if you can see that. Let me make it a bit larger. There's some little thing here. Yeah, it was big anyway. So yeah, 1,094 instances of label type, the string label type. That's pretty useful. And you must bear in mind that each of these strings is actually twice as long as it looks, because it's a UTF-2 string instead of a UTF-8 string. Another interesting choice. So it's actually quite big. So that wastes, you know, 31k, just that one. And then again, type, UI name, and so, you know, as you get down here, you start seeing font names that are particularly popular, Lucida, Unicode, and so on some of these other guys. Now, I happen to have I happen to have something here somewhere. Let me find it. Just in my elite personal hacks sort of style. Let me look at the end of this. Did anyone see any of that? No. Anyway, it's the raw, unprocessed, non-spreadsheet output the other way up. Let me add some lines at the bottom so you can see the punchline. But either way, you know, now the next maximum one is x default and config string, and I'm starting to look at some of these. But the punchline is it's a lot better. You see no font stuff in here. It tails off much more quickly from 600 down to only 44 copies of, or 30 copies of, you know, some of these things. And, you know, there's quite a long tail. I mean, there's quite, you see there's some serious UNO goodness for the UI code seems to be duplicating whole tons of stuff, and, you know, so it goes on. Luckily, many strings are only one instance off, but there's quite a lot of badness there. But either way, it's dropping off a lot more quickly than previously, and saving, you know, a good chunk of memory, improved performance, and improved stuff. So we've come down here, we're still in the 70s and 40s and so on. So that's worth doing, and very easy to do, as it happens, which is always good. I've nearly finished. That's good. So, the future work, I guess, we need more code sharing. We need to reduce the number of libraries. We need to cut old libraries that are effectively bloat out. VOS, V-O-S, there's libraries that have been substantially removed from the code, but seem to have a more friendly API than some of these other core platform libraries that can never change. And so people tend to use them instead of the core platform libraries that we should be using. And so they tend never to die, these things, but they need someone to violently remove them, and perhaps in the process to improve the SAL APIs that replace them, so people are happy. So it would be nice to reduce the code size. Each library allocates at least one page for all of its writable pieces. And it's interesting looking at the PMAP output and just seeing page after page of small 4K shared libraries that, you know, that we could aggregate together. Configuration Manager. So yeah, there's a whole load of custom structures in here, and it has its own string structure for a good reason, which is that it was designed to have shared memory coherence, shared memory
configuration storage across multiple processes, which is a fair design decision when it was made, but it's no longer necessary in our world, and it has a substantial cost. So, configuration manager also suffers from the UNO phenomenon. Let me just be a bit rude about UNO here. which is that, some people think that multi-threaded programming, this is where I get really controversial. The best way to do multi-threaded programming is sort of the Java way. You have a synchronized attribute on every object, right? So every object has a mutex, and you can, whatever it is, it has a great lock in the corner, Yeah? And every time you call a method on it, you take the lock, and every time you return, you drop the lock again, hey? That's multi-threading for you. Wonderful. The problem is that if this is a list of things like this, and everything is nicely multi-threaded, in between your calls to it, as you iterate along this thing, anything could happen, and might happen in a threaded environment. We encourage it to happen. You can have multiple other callers coming and vandalizing your structure while you're trying to just do a simple iteration of what's there. And so you see real violence being done in the name of thread safety and small object granularity and this sort of thing to make UNO happy. So for example, as an example off the top of my head, I've been saving memory in calc, reducing the cell size. And in order to have a perfectly beautiful thread-safe experience, when you're saving a document, every single cell is scanned in your spreadsheet to see if it has a post-it note. Now that's just a structural structural problem. We can easily fix that. Every cell is scanned, which may be tons of rows and a good number of columns. But when you're iterating over the post-it notes, you have an UNO interface which takes an index, so get note or whatever it's called. It's probably not called get note. It's probably called get thing, because there's a great love of generics here. So get note, and it takes effectively an index. So that's fine. Well, when index is zero, the first element in the array, you iterate along until you find, this post-it note here. And that's fine. You return an UNO structure that represents this. All is good. When you want the second one, you iterate along here again, and, many millions, and you get the second one, that's here, that's fine, and you return that. When you want the third one, you iterate along all over again. And the reason for this is that clearly any or all of these may have disappeared at any time from any other thread. And so, the config manager suffers from this with a vengeance because it also emits callbacks. So when configuration stuff happens, it can emit callbacks which can re-enter and do all sorts of evil things to the data structures. And basically it causes incomparable grief. And so there's a huge amount of duplication, a huge amount of locking overhead. To get one key takes, I think, 150 locks on average. You take and release. I mean, it's 150 take and release. Just to get one key, that's just to get a string. So there's clearly some room for improving this situation. And I think probably the best way to do it is it's a chunky API. Because probably you don't just want one key, you want a whole lot of keys, or this set of keys. And so I think really improving APIs so that they are much more chunky and you say, get UI, get all of these keys in the UI framework and it returns you a huge chunk of data in an end, hopefully without copying it too many times. So I'm interested in creating a chunky API there if I have the resources to carry on with this stuff. In terms of offenders, for memory usage, Calc is blessed with being able to create vast amounts of data very easily, with a fill function or copy and paste or whatever you like to think about it. And we're pretty size-wise, we're very large versus Excel. So there are a few obvious things that need doing. This I shouldn't have done first, but I thought it would be easy. Of course, it turned out not to be. But anyway, there's a patch to do this that's in the works and works pretty well. Yeah, each cell has 4 bytes to remember what row it's in, and there's a rather inefficient sparse array to remember where cells are. And that should be much easier. Yeah, relatively easy to fix. It's a sparse array that includes a row number for every cell. And typically cells are in large ranges. So I think we can do a lot better with the sparse array and save 4 bytes a cell or 4 meg every 1,000,000,000,000 cells. Yeah. So that's the plan. I'll send you the patch when it works. And I think the big thing is the string duplication, that when people do the most data-intensive things with huge pivot data series that come in, typically the data is repeated again and again and again, which is why you're using the pivot data feature to mine it and produce results. Apparently we duplicate all of that 17 times, and we need to just be a bit cleverer there. And again, well, performance-wise, the data pilot representation is not efficient, in my view. So, some things have worked to fix, and the conclusions. There we are. So, things are getting a lot better, and hopefully getting better quickly. And, yeah, I think that the memory, the code size is still critical. We need to just somehow be reducing the amount of code we load. SVX has, I forget how many megabytes of dialogue in it, none of which are used at startup. And then some other stuff, but it's not clear why we're linking all of that in. strings getting fixed. You know, if you don't want me to send you a patch mentioning that your code wastes tons of memory, you might want to just check the spreadsheet to see if you recognize any of the strings as your own. And that's where it is. So thank you very much. You've been very patient. Are there any questions? Come on, Kai, you've had your mouth open for most of the... The upper bound is probably 2.5 megabytes, right? In terms of that's what we allocate at the moment. I don't know in terms of the raw memory we save. I can generate some numbers. I send mails to the list every week or so with here's another 50k of apparent memory, much more real memory. Oh, no, the hash is not... Okay, right, so the hash is only a debugging tool to detect where the duplication is. That's not in my patch. The patches tend to be of the form, don't create this string again and again and again, create a member that is the string, and then reuse it again and again. Although, in some cases, like the VCL font stuff, clearly you just need a hash set there, because there's only 20 strings that are reused thousands of times or something, So there is a hash in that case. I don't know. Anything global has to go into SAL, and getting anything into SAL is, we have to argue with architects for hours, So anyway, So it's a good question. I think the, so one suggestion then is to have a hash in SAL that allows you to create strings that you know are programmatic, and will live a long time and are used multiple times. So key names that you know will be duplicated, or strings that you're constantly looking up in XML files. And there are duplicates of that all over the code. So XML off, as I recall, has code that does this to reduce duplication and allocation and so on. But then, then you can get into arguments of is it quicker to hash something or is it quicker to allocate it, take a lock on this multi-thread hashing. But that's a kind of religious argument. It seems easier to just go and add a few simple hashes around the place that are protected already, or use member variables you can reuse when you're allocating the strings. So that's the approach I'm taking so far. And the configuration manager thing is so nice because it saved just such a mind-blowing amount of memory that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting something like 250k out of that. And to get 850, it must have been the case that many of these strings were just holding copies of what was already in the configuration cache, right? And now they're all one string. It's just not holding a copy. It's just passing it straight through. So that's a nice way. Another question. I'm bullish. This man here with the FRI t-shirt.
Yes. Part of the solution would perhaps be also modularization. Is that also scheduled? Louis said something about that. I don't know on which
game. Oh, that's good. I'm glad Louis said something about that. Modularization. Well, the thing is, OpenOffice is very modular, If you look at the source directory, there are tons of separate DLLs there, It is very modular. Unfortunately, but of course there are still big lumps. I mean, SVX and is one big lump that has absolutely tons of stuff in it. Canvas, 100,000 dialogues, it's just a big dumping ground. And then there's SFX, which was a lot bigger, but then they moved the whole load of stuff here, and often they left it here too. But then there are a whole load of very tiny pieces of software here. So the shared library loader is a component, a shared library, which is pretty cool, right? I mean, that's kind of twisted, right? So we have loads of really quite tiny things, and then a few intermediate components like configuration manager and so on, and then some really huge dumping beast grounds that need to be, the swamp needs draining. But it's not just modularization, it's ensuring that you get only what you want, and you're not loading AV media during your writer startup when there's no AV media anywhere.
You're just loading what you get.
Right. And part of this problem is also, well, okay, not to slate Uno, I'm a big fan of Uno, but it's partly Uno related. In as much as when you create an Uno interface, often there are legacy classes you want to interface with, or there's other functionality you want to wrap around it, such you also create a helper library that makes it much more usable. So you don't just get UCB, you get UCB helper as well. And this is, you know, this is a really small piece of code just to help this library. But you don't just get UCB helper, you get, I don't know, CPPU helper and some other helpers. And, you know, so there are lots of little libraries full of not much wrapper code to make this stuff more pleasant to use, or, you know, with legacy code or whatever. So, I don't know, modularization. Put modularization in the right way so that we aggregate things that are common and, you know, not other things. But yeah, it's not something I can really work on. It takes global vision and knowledge and actual understanding of the code and this site. You know, that's all. I never got that. So, good question. Man in the back, who's?
You said linking targets and movements only apply to Linux.
That's correct.
Does that mean that the problems don't exist on your Windows or other platforms, or there hasn't been a solution being implemented yet? Windows,
the linking problem is substantially non-existent because they, I think, pre-link as they compile. They also drastically reduce what is exposed. And the one definition rule can be handled in other ways that are more efficient. And I think Microsoft handle their, you know, these cases that cause longer lookups more intelligently. And yeah, I mean, you know, that, I don't perceive there's a problem there, but I'm not a Windows expert by any means. So sorry, I'd love to have fixed your Windows problem too. But of course all the memory savings will help you, the calc core changes, you know, to improve. So Jody's work on pivots, data pilot stuff is, you know, is a win for Windows people. How are we doing for time? How many more questions do I have? Someone? Does someone have a watch at all?
A couple of minutes.
Okay, I'll take yours, and I'll take two more.
Regarding hiding symbols.
Yes.
There has been some work on it, and do you think it's worth to do a more fine-grained work on it?
Hiding symbols?
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, so hiding symbols is painful, as I understand it. Often you need a map file, which is separate to the code, which is a disaster area. But then often, you know, the better way is to annotate the code, which is painful too, but less of a disaster area. But then when you refactor the code, often the thing you want is hidden. Or not hidden. So, you know, it creates cross-platform problems and problems with that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do. It's what we should do. But it does create pain. We have some patches that add visibility markup to two other modules in the next worst defender zone. But, yeah, they should be going upstream. Intel did them. Talk?
Do you know why does OpenOffice use Unicode strings for stuff that is always ASCII anyway?
Yes, you did notice in my spreadsheet here the number of the Japanese strings, did you? I mean, you know, there's a serious, you know, I don't know, of these 2.5 megabytes of string to do nothing, none of them are Unicode. So I don't know, that's a question for an architect. We'll go and beat someone up later. But no, I would love to convert the strings to UTF-8. I don't think, of course, the common thing is, but you can't get the length of the string if it's in UTF-8 quickly. And hey, that's true, but what does the length of a string mean? It's certainly not the size when you render it on the screen, by any means, you know, because it could be in some weird language that just twists everything up into a tiny ball when you render it. So, is it really helpful? I don't know. It seems an interesting question. Okay, well, there are no more questions. So thank you so much. You've been very patient.